Beruchim Abayim, ladies. We're studying this week Perashat Vayera, most interesting Perashah. Of course, the end of Perashat Lech Lecha, we discussed that Borei Olam told Avraham Avinu that he must circumcise himself. At that time, Avraham Avinu was 99 years old. Our parasha opens up actually on the third day of the circumcision. Our rabbis tell us in general, the third day of any operation is usually the most difficult of days. And therefore, a milah, which was done in those days without any anesthesia or something like that, definitely pained Avraham. And the Torah tells us on the third day God came to visit Avraham. From here we learn the law. Our law tells us we must emulate God. How do you emulate God? Whatever God does, you follow. God performs the mitzvah of Bikur Hodim. He came to visit Avraham. So from there we learn, just like he visits the sick people, you also have an obligation to visit the sick people. The interesting part of this story is that in the middle of the conversation that God is talking to Avraham, whatever they're talking about, the Torah doesn't tell us what they were talking about, all of a sudden Avraham sees from the corner of his eye some guests, some wayfarers. We know they were angels. He didn't know they were angels. They looked like Arabs. Avraham Avinu tells God, excuse me, God, he puts Hashem on hold, and he says, I have to go take care of the guests. From here we learn, the Gemara says, that hospitality is so important and so great that it even overrides talking to God. If you'd asked me a second ago, what's more important, talking to Hashem or giving coffee to an Arab, to a wayfarer? So what do you mean, talking to God? For me, you see, no. Because Avraham told Borei Olam, I can't talk to you now. There's an overriding mitzvah to be done. And that's the mitzvah of Echnasat Orchim. My question was, how did Avraham know that? We know it because Avraham did it. But who told Avraham he was allowed to put God on hold? What was his source? They explain it like this. To show you what type of giant of a man Avraham Avinu was. Avraham's original name was Avram. They added the letter here to his name. Numerically, Avram equals 243. By adding the letter here to his name, it equals 248. The exact number of limbs in a man's body. Avraham was called Avram because all his limbs were so holy and so sensitive to mitzvot that any time there was a mitzvah to be done, he had a certain sensation in that limb of the body. So when he was sitting and talking with God, he felt his legs starting to move. He felt his legs start to pick him up. That was the greatest indication to Avraham, if his legs are moving in the direction of the guests, his legs don't lie. After all, he's called Avraham. He's a man that his whole body is like a Sefer Torah, is the holiest entity possible. Therefore, he knew that he has to follow his feeling in this case, and therefore he told God that he must go to an overriding mitzvah. It should be pointed out, on that day it was the hottest day ever recorded in history. Borei Olam took the sun out of its shell, as she says. Now the sun with the shell on, you can have maybe 110 degrees, maybe in Texas you can have 120 degrees, maybe that's the record, 125 degrees. But the sun without the shell, it could be 150 degrees, 106, who knows how hot it was. God did that on purpose, not to bother Avraham. God knew that if it'll be a nice cool day, there'll be people walking in the street, and then Avraham's going to have to deal with them. So God was doing Avraham a favor. I'll make it very hot, so nobody will trouble Avraham that he has to deal with them with hospitality. But when God saw that Avraham was more bothered that he didn't have guests, so then God said, what did I change the whole world for? I was only doing this as a favor to Avraham, not to bother him. But he's more bothered by the fact that there's no guests to deal with. Therefore, Borei Olam provided him these guests. Of course, Avraham sees the guests and he gets up and he deals with them. Hafetz Chaim asked the question. Avraham had 318 servants. He's talking to God. When he saw the guests, you know what he should have done? He should have told one of his servants, handle it. The guests are coming. I'm talking to Hashem. Take care of the guests. Get them food. Get them a drink. Get them everything. Why did Avraham not delegate the responsibility of taking care of guests to one of the servants? And the explanation is, and this is a very great yesod, according to the importance of the guest, sometimes the host himself must make the effort himself. That's the respect of the guest. These men to Avraham looked important. Therefore he felt it would not be respect to the guest to have the butler take care of him. It's a great lesson. Many times Rav Pam says, an ani comes to the door to collect money. We're talking about a legitimate man. A beggar, he comes to the door, please, I'm collecting for such and such a yeshiva. Many times, what do? We tell our children, here's a dollar, go give it to the guy. Now, even though you're training your child to give charity, but you're also training your child that beggar is not important. Because if it was an important man, you'd come to the door yourself. So while you're training him for one thing, but you're also training him on a negative thing. Therefore, Rav Pam says, when a beggar comes to the door, you're supposed to take your child with you to the ani, and you give him a dollar, and the child gives him a dollar. But at least you're giving the impression that guests are important. Should be pointed out, you think Avraham cared about food? No, Avraham was not concerned about food. Our rabbis tell us food is one of the biggest indulgences. Food is like a very big yetzer hara. Of course you have to eat, we don't say no. But Avraham, certainly he had nothing to do with food and eating and all that. But when it came to his guests, he did not impose his own religious stringencies on his guests. Bottom line, guests like to eat. Bottom line, guests like to enjoy. He wasn't going to tell his guests, what do you think, I'm going to make you meat now? After all, it says he slaughtered 3 cows. And he gave each one a piece of tongue, and Rashi says with mustard. You think Avraham was such a technical guy, he would only eat tongue with mustard, with condiments? Of course not. For himself, Avraham Avinu probably would have ate black bread and water. But when it comes to his guests, he provides the best. One rabbi learned a great rule from over here. Somebody else's physical needs becomes your spiritual needs. Listen to what we just said. We just said a sharp line. Somebody else's physical needs to us is considered a spiritual need. Therefore, we cannot come along and say, well, what am I going to spoil him with drinks and food and luxury? It's better he should abstain from the pleasures of life. Yeah, you could say that about yourself. If you want to abstain from eating all these things, you're a big tzaddik. But don't be a tzaddik on your guest's chesbon. When it comes to giving the guest, you give him everything, all the delicacies in life, and let the guest decide whether he wants to abstain or not. But it's your obligation to provide the best. Now, it should be pointed out, Avraham Avinu tells his servant, bring me a little water in order that we should give it to the guests to clean their feet. Yukahna me'at mayim. So all the rabbis ask, Avraham Avinu all of a sudden is conserving water? When it came to the meat, he slaughters 3 cows in a very generous way. When it comes to the bread, Sarah makes a whole oven full of bread. When it comes to the water, I only take a little water. Why was he being very, very careful on the water? And the rabbis explain, because everything else he did himself. But the water he told one of the servants to get. And we learn a lesson from here. That if you want to do things in a great way, to be very religious and very, very mahmir, that's good, but to yourself. But when you're demanding from others, you cannot demand from them more than the law requires. I want to be a tzaddik on whose back? On his back? Avraham's not going to say, bring a lot of water. So he looks good that he brought a lot of water. And who had to carry the water? Miskin, the shaliach. Ha-mahmir yahmir ala tzmo. In religion, those people that want to be stringent, ashrayim. They should be blessed. They're holy. But stringencies, Avraham is telling you, is for yourself. To impose your stringency upon others. Therefore, when it came to him, he's slaughtering 3 animals, 3 tongues. He cooked it, he did everything.
But when it comes to telling somebody else, bring water, bring a little water. If you want to bring a lot, that's your own thing, but I can only tell you to do the minimum required. There was one rabbi called Rav Yisrael Salanter. Rav Yisrael Salanter once was making Nitilat Yadayim. They saw the people before him, each guy was using a cup of Nitilat Yadayim like this. They're pouring. The Gemara says if you use a lot of Nitilat Yadayim water, you become wealthy. So the custom is to fill up the keli, fill up the cup, let it overflow, and you pour with large measures. Al Nitilat Yadayim, the letters spell Ani. Ani, Al Nitilat Yadayim. Therefore, those people want to become rich, use a lot of water. So they saw Rabbi Yisrael Salanter making Nitilat Yadayim, using the minimum amount of water. They told him, Hakam, don't you know the Gemara? He said, I want to ask you a question. Where do you think this water came from? They didn't have sinks in those days. The old lady has to go to the well and draw the water and bring it to the basin. I'm going to become rich on her back. If I draw the water myself, you can use all the water you want. But she should have to draw extra water so I can be mahmir on Nitilat Yadayim. This is against ethics. Another time, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was invited by a very important businessman for dinner on Friday night. And the businessman was impressing the rabbi. We have the best Friday night. It's pizmonim. And we say Devrei Torah. And we sit and we talk. And the food, glad kasher, basar, bet yosef, and kemach yashan, and so on. And the lady that cooks the food is a widow, tzaddeket. She was married to a tamid hakam. She cooks the food with all kavanot. Please, would you eat over? Rav Yisrael Salanter says, my pleasure on one condition. The meal cannot take more than 2 hours. He says, wait, 2 hours? Rabbi, we sit for hours. We sit 4 hours, 5 hours. What do you mean 2 hours? The rabbi said, 2 hours, otherwise I'm not coming. Said, okay, the guy figures, once I get the rabbi here, he'll see how enjoyable it is. He'll stay the whole night. Sure enough, Rav Yisrael Salanter sits down. He's eating at the meal. 2 hours on the dot. Berkat HaMazon. Berkat HaMazon, Hakam, in the middle. We didn't impress you? Berkat HaMazon. After dinner, he says, bring out the lady that made the food. The lady comes out from the kitchen. The rabbi says, please, you'll forgive me. I'm a guest. Maybe you had to cook extra for me tonight. Forgive me for, maybe I had to put you out. She says, Rabbi, put me out. This was the greatest Friday night of my life. These people usually sit till 2 o'clock in the morning. I don't get home till 3 o'clock. I'm tired. Tonight we finished in 2 hours. It's the best thing. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says, you're being mahmir on your Friday night meal. You're enjoying. Very religious. But on whose back? On this poor widow's back. She has to suffer because you want to stay up all night and sing songs on the Friday night table. You see, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, what a brilliant man. He himself was so pious. Nobody close to his piety. But when it came to other people, he always took them into consideration. How is my behavior going to affect somebody else? Therefore, Avraham Avinu tells his servant, Yukachna me'at mayim. Take a little water, because he did it ayedeh shaliyah. The angels enter the house. They ask Avraham, Ayeh Sarah Eshtecha? Where's your wife? Where's Sarah? Abraham answers, Hine ba'ohel. She's in the tent. Our rabbis are bothered. What kind of question is this of an angel? Yes, Sarah Eshtecha. Where's Sarah? That's what we expect a question from a malach. Where's your wife? What do you, machpat lecha and my wife? What's the difference? It's my wife. What do you care where she is? And Abraham answers, oh, she's inside. You don't think the angels knew? Angels have x-ray vision. They know everything. That they have to ask Abraham, where's Sarah? And the rabbis come and tell us a very great lesson over here. From here you learn a rule in protocol. When you go to somebody's house and you're sitting at the table and they're serving roast, and you know the hostess, the lady of the house, made the roast. Who made the roast? They invited you. She probably cooked all the food. The proper protocol is to ask the husband, wow, who made the roast? Delicious. What does the husband say? Oh, my wife. Wow, your wife. Why do you do that? In order to endear the wife on the husband. So you point it out to him. You don't have to do that. It's known. But you say it on purpose so the husband feels good. See what a good wife I have? See that? The guests appreciate the type of roast that she made. These malachim over here, they knew Sarah was in the tent. And that's where she belonged. She was a modest lady. But they wanted to point it out to Avraham. Where's your wife, Avraham? Oh, she's in the tent. Oh, she's modest. Wow, what a great lady. So they did it on purpose. So Avraham will hear how great and how lucky of a wife that he married. Hence, the protocol always is to say things that even are superfluous in order to create the shalom bayit. Now, let me point this out. Who are you talking about here? Avraham and Sarah. They had a great marriage. You'd think their marriage didn't need to be enhanced. You know, maybe you're talking about somebody's marriage that's on the rocks. So then you need all these tricks in order to make them love each other. Avraham and Sarah, they're the epitome. That's the best marriage in history. And still, what do you see? The Malachim went out of their way in order to create an extra bond between Avraham and his wife. So specifically they asked, where's Sarah? Knowing the answer, but they wanted Avraham to hear it. Oh, my wife, very modest, she's inside. Oh, wow, you're a lucky guy, beautiful. In order to make it a little better, the relationship between Avraham and Sarah. Now, Sarah hears the good news that she's going to have a baby. She laughs. She says, what are you talking about? I'm going to have a baby? Adoni Zaken, my husband, he's an old man. My husband's 99 years old. Who's having a baby? She laughed. She couldn't believe that Avraham, such an old man, would be able to have a baby. Okay. God was upset at Sarah. What are you laughing for? I thought you're going to have a baby. You're going to have a baby. So God goes to Avraham. Vayomer Hashem al Avraham. Lama ze sa'aka Sarah? Why is Sarah laughing? Saying that she's too old to have a baby. Hold it. God, that's not what she said. Sarah said that Avraham's too old. God comes along and now gets involved in what we call maybe Chas v'Shalom, but this is what it is, a little white lie, or stretching the truth a little. Why does God change the truth over here? Because again, God is teaching you that in cases of Shalom Bayit, to keep peace between man and wife, you're allowed to change the truth. If God would have repeated it to Avraham as Sarah said it, oh, she says impossible, you're an old man. Oh, she said I'm an old man, oh, that's what she's talking about me? What kind of business is this over here? She's also an old lady. So therefore God, in order to keep the balance in Shalom, says, no, she says she's old. Oh, she's old? Okay. She didn't say anything about me, right? No, nothing about you, how about her? So you see over here, great lesson. In Shalom Bayit, in keeping peace between husband and wife, God himself went and changed the truth. It's a great lesson. But I always had a problem. God comes to Avraham complaining about Sarah. Go to Sarah. Hazi, what did Avraham do? Avraham's a good man. God comes to him. What's kind of business? Sarah's laughing. Why is she laughing? You have a problem with Sarah? Go to Sarah straight. Sarah was a prophetess. Let God come to Sarah and say, Sarah, please, we promised you. It's no reason to laugh. And the explanation the rabbis tell us, is if we see a lady in her emunah or in her practice of mitzvot slacking off, who is to blame? Her husband. The husband, that means, is not on top of the situation. The husband is allowing his wife to get away with things. He's being lenient with her. If you see a lady that's not careful in making Birkat HaMazon, so we go to the husband, how do you allow it? You're sitting with your wife, you see she doesn't make Birkat HaMazon after dinner. I don't want to bother her, she's busy. But if you would say something and the lady would know that religion is important to you, you do it. Of course, but he doesn't make an issue of it. So therefore, God goes to Avraham, Sarah's laughing. Avraham, it's your fault. Because if you made it important that she shouldn't laugh at such things, she wouldn't have laughed. Very important lesson. After that, we read about the destruction of the city of Sodom. Amazing story. Amazing story. Pasuk writes that God tells Sodom, God tells Avraham, we're going to destroy the whole city. So Avraham starts to tell God, please, 50 tzaddikim, 40, this. He's making deals with God. God says, listen, if you could find me 10 righteous people living in Sodom, v'nasati lechol ha'ir ba'avuram, I'll do away with my decree and I will sustain the whole city for the 10 tzaddikim. Our rabbis tell us of Musar You understand what it means, hachamim? You understand what it means, rabbis? You understand what it means to have scholars in the city? Imagine there were 10 scholars living in Sodom, and God wouldn't have destroyed the city. Would anybody in Sodom, if they were asked the question, what's the zechut that this city is sustained? How come you're living today? What would they say? What do you mean, how come we're living today? We're living because we're living. What do you mean? Like every other country we're living. You think they would have known that the reason why they're existing is in the zechut of the 10 tzaddikim? They never would have known that. And I ask you a question. We're living, Baruch Hashem, in our country, in America. Who knows if we don't have a zechut to live in our country because there's 10 tzaddikim, or maybe more, hachamim living in our midst, that in their zechut, they're pumping the electricity into this country that are keeping it in existence. Why is it different than Sodom? And let me make another point to you. Isn't it a little ironic or coincidence that we don't believe in coincidence? That before all this destruction that we're witnessing in our country today, a lot of the Gedolim, a lot of the Tzaddikim perished. Is it a coincidence that Rabbi Miller, that lived right in our midst, died this year, and Rabbi Gifter from Cleveland Yeshiva, and Rabbi Kalevsky from Baltimore Yeshiva, and Rav Palm from Torah Vada'at, four pillars, four Tzaddikim, left America in 1 year? That's frightening. And look what happened to our country. There is no doubt that there's a connection between the stability of a country and its righteous people. These were all American-born Tamidei Hakamim, raised in America. It should be pointed out what's going on with Israel today. Rav Shachi should live and be well, 107 years old. Unfortunately, the rabbi was put on a respirator yesterday. Shem Yishlachu Refuah Shelema. Rav Chaim Kanievsky, the son of the stipler, received a stroke on Sukkot. Today he's not able to learn like he was able to learn anymore. He has to walk around with a walker and he's taking therapy. Rav Steinemann the other day, Gadol Ador, fell out of his bed and broke his hip. Here you're seeing Gedolim. Each one is a dynamo. Each one is a giant in his own right. You see the Tzaddikim. What does that mean? It means that Bar Minan, we have to pray that the Tzaddikim exist, because as long as they're alive and they're okay, Rav Shach on a respirator can do more for the world than most people alive singing and dancing and eating. He's more productive on a respirator to the world than most people that are alive. Therefore, our prayer must be for the Tzaddikim that are sustaining the world. You know, the Gemara tells a story. Actually, it's not a Gemara, it's a Midrash. Listen to the story. There was a general called Bar Kokhba. Jewish man. Bar Kokhba had 200,000 soldiers. He was living in a city called Betar. The city of Betar was being attacked by the Romans. The Roman general was called Adrianus. Adrianus was trying to break the city for 3.5 years. 3.5 years he couldn't get into the city. Finally, one goy comes to Adrianus. He was about to give up. He says, we can't get these guys. They're too strong. A Gentile goes to Adrianus and says, listen, you're attacking them the wrong way. You have to go after their strength. Tell me, who's their strength? There's a rabbi in the town called Rabbi El-Azhar. If you get Rabbi El-Azhar, you'll be able to attack him in no time. How do we get Rabbi El-Azhar? We'll get him. They send in a fellow to the city. The rabbi's in the middle of saying Kiryat Shema one day. The fellow comes to Rabbi El-Azhar and whispers something in his ear. All of a sudden the people say, what? Rabbi El-Azhar, he's talking to the enemy. What does the enemy have to do with Rabbi El-Azhar? So Bar Kokhba goes to Rabbi El-Azhar, to the goy. What did you tell Rabbi El-Azhar? I'm not going to tell you the secrets. What secrets? There's secrets going on. Bar Kokhba goes to Rabbi El-Azhar. Tell me what the guy told you. What do you mean? I was saying Kiryat Shema. I didn't even hear what he said. What? You're a liar? Bar Kokhba got so angry, he killed Rabbi El-Azhar. This was his uncle, by the way. He killed Rabbi El-Azhar. Terrible story. The Midrash says, P.S., shortly thereafter, the city of Betar fell. So you see over here, there's definite connection between the Tzaddikim living and the Hakamim living and studying and praying, and when the city is being sustained. Therefore, our attitude, ladies, must be, when we see a fellow walking out of the Miri Yeshiva on Ocean Parkway, instead of looking at them, miskinim, studying in the kollel, wasting their time. This is an attitude that most of us have, unfortunately. Who knows if we're not living in the zechut of these rabbis that are dedicating their life to study Torah all day long. And who's the miskin? Who's living off of who? We think we're supporting them because we give them a few dollars and therefore they have a small stipend that they can't even support themselves on Azaton. And we think we're doing them a favor. They're doing us the biggest favor. Through their studying of Torah, the yeshivot, the kolelim, they are giving us life. And that's what we learn from Sedom. God would have rid himself from the decree if there were just 10 righteous people living in Sedom. Avraham Avinu in Perasha also, when he's negotiating with God, he says, God, please, I know I'm nothing. Who am I to negotiate with you? He calls himself Afar Va'efer. He calls himself, I'm nothing, I'm dust and ashes. The rabbis learned from there that Abraham was a very humble man. But what does it mean, dust and ashes? I mean, it's a nice metaphor. When a person wants to make himself humble, I'm nothing, I'm dirt, I'm zero. But did he choose these words specifically? The rabbis say yes. Dust, earth, dirt. Dirt has no past. But if you plant in dirt, it might have a future. Trees will come out of it. Vegetation will come out of it. The past of dirt, the past of afar, is zero. Efer, ashes, is the exact opposite. Where do ashes come from? From a table, let's say. But the table burnt. Ashes have a past. But ashes do not have a future. Avraham, in his humility, was saying, Va'anochi afar va'efer, God, I'm like afar. That whatever I did in the past is insignificant. And I'm like efer, I'm like ashes. Whatever I'm going to do in the future is insignificant like ashes. So he was reflecting the two points of his life. His past, not enough what I did. And what I'm going to do, efer, it's valueless, insignificant to what I'm supposed to do. Then we read the story of Avraham and Sarah visiting the city of Pelishtim. Once again, as we discussed in a previous class, he finds himself in the palace immediately. This time the palace of Avimelech. Avimelech, Melech, Pelishtim. And of course, Sarah being a beautiful lady, as we said, the king has his eye on her, and the king says, he wants her. Of course, Avraham has to say, well, she's my sister, no problem. Had he said that he was the husband, Abimelech would have killed him. So therefore, he has to make a scheme. No, I'm a brother, this is my sister, if you want her, take her. Sure enough, Abimelech takes her. That night, God comes to Abimelech in a dream. What are you doing? You took the rabbi's wife. Return her. He said, what rabbi? I didn't know it's his wife. He told me it's his sister. Return her. The next morning he comes up, he says, Avraham, Dachilak, what did you do to me? You told me it's your sister, that's why I took her. If you would have told me it was your wife, I wouldn't have touched her. Why did you fool me? It's a good question. Avimelech says, what do you want from us? You fooled me, you set me up. So what does Avraham say? Avraham says, because I saw, Rak en yirat Elohim b'makom hazeh v'haraguni. Listen to what he said. I saw that there is no fear of God in this town. And therefore I felt you might kill me. And that's the only thing I saw missing. Rak, only. Meaning I assessed the town when I walked in. I saw what type of people you are. My assessment is you have everything. What do you mean everything? I saw that you're decent people. You have derech eres. You're ethical people. I see that you're moral people. Everybody said, good morning. How do you do? Madame, monsieur, ladies first. All the proper ethical rules you followed. And I saw that you were quite decent. But that's not enough for Avraham. Because Avraham knows that man is an animal. It's very easy for man to act ethical until he wants something. Once his desires get the best of him, all the ethics go in the garbage. all the morals mean nothing. And therefore, the only thing that can control man at the time of his desire is fear of God. Yirat Shamayim. Fear of God is the only thing that will harness a person's bad traits at the time of indulgence. He says, yes, you people are very good, but there was no God, there's no fear of God. Therefore, true, you act very nicely, but once a pretty girl is placed in front of you, all your ethics are out the window. Now you'd kill me. What? An ethical man would kill? Yeah. He looks like an ethical man. But when push comes to shove and now he sees something dangling in front of his eyes, he turns into a monster. You see how important Yirat Shamayim is? Rav Elchanan Wasserman said this, Hiddush. You know what he said it in regarding? He said it in regarding the Germans in Nazi Germany. He said, be careful, Rabotai. He called it before the Holocaust, he said. Be careful of these Germans. The Germans were the most decent of people. I had a rabbi I used to study with. He used to live in Munich. The rabbi used to tell me, when you ask the German for directions, he would tell you, follow me. And he'd take you 10 miles out of his way. That was ethics. That was a Derech Eretz. And then after you'd get there, he'd come out of the car and say, this is where you wanted to go, correct? A nice way of talking. In a nice, polite way. This is where you wanted to go. Is that correct? Is that right? What a beautiful way of talking. But Rav Elchanan Wasserman said, be careful. It's skin deep, this decency. When the time comes, this decency will be washed away and you'll see the true monster. You'll see the true beast come out. They said, what are you talking about? Scientists, doctors, professionals. No different than the American people. And sure enough, we saw the thin veneer of ethics without fear of God. When their hatred of the Jew surfaced, all the ethics and all the decency and all the proper behavior and etiquette, as they were killing us, they were killing us with ethics. One rabbi said, as they were killing him, they were chopping his arm off Bar Minan without any sedative. And as they're chopping the arm of the German says, it hurts, it hurts you, it hurts you. In a nice way, in a soft tone. Behemoth! With their ethics, they're killing people. Why? No Yirat Shamayim. There's no fear of God. Everybody is suspect to their desires and to the worst crimes. Is our country any different? Our country, the law of the land says that abortion is permissible. That's the law of the land. That means judges ruled that it's permissible to make an abortion. Now, nobody argues that that's murder. We have sonograms today. We see the baby. We see it alive. We see it very alive. How can a country that's built on freedom and on justice, on the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, big sign, justice for all. Except when we don't want to have justice for all. When it comes to other cases, somebody murders, oh, we make a big deal. Innocent people dying in the war, or the peace, the pacifists, oh, it's a shame, we're killing innocent people. Where are you when they're killing babies every day in abortion centers? What happened? So therefore, when there's no Yirat Shamayim, so then the ethics become all mixed up and all. You'll kill when you want to kill, and when you don't want to kill, you won't want to kill. But those that have Yirat Shamayim, they're consistent. Imagine if somebody would come in the street, see a stranger, and throw a punch at him and knock him out. Throw him in jail. There'd be court cases. It'd be on the news. It'd be a terrible thing. That's forbidden in our country. Justice. On the same hand, we go to boxing matches. What's a boxing match? Fans sit around when two people stand in a ring with the sole intent to kill each other. And as the guys are hitting each other, what's the reaction of the people? Yeah, kill him, get him down. Get him. What type of sadistic sport are we watching? What type of craziness? Is football any different? Where people get together and watch people attack and sack the quarterback and kill and knock and concussions. most violent of all sports is football. But we got caught up in such a culture. No, football is different. Football is enjoyable. What's enjoyable? It's a violent sport. Boxing, violent. Because when there's no Yirat Shamayim, this violence is forbidden, but you have to enjoy it. So this violence is permissible. But you got to be very careful. Because if they can say that the violence on a football field is permissible, one day when they start killing Jews, they can say this violence is also permissible. Because we make the rules. When you have to answer to God, then already there's different rules. See, Jews would never be allowed, even in a football game, to start clobbering each other in the name of sport. Because our religion says you can't lay your hand on a fellow Jew. You can't even raise your hand on a fellow Jew. Even in jest. Even in sport. So we would never have this problem because we're working with a book. We're working with a guide. We're working with Yirat Shamayim. So Avraham tells Avimelech, I saw a lot of good things in this town. I saw a lot of good people. But I saw it was a facade. It was a mask. Because you had no Yirat Shamayim. Therefore, I really got scared. I thought you were actually going to kill me. That's why I had to tell you that it was my sister and it wasn't my wife. Because I was really scared that your ethics would dissipate immediately. The end of the parasha. We read about Akedat Yitzhak. Of course, Akedat Yitzhak is one of the highlights of the parasha. Bezat Hashem will talk about it more on Shabbat. But just to make a few points. At the end of the Akedat Yitzhak, after Avraham passes the test, he's about to sacrifice Yitzhak on the Mizbeach. God tells him, no, don't do it. I see you're loyal to me. You're willing to follow my wishes. And God tells Avraham, Avraham, Avraham. He calls him twice. He wants to stop him. Don't do it. Avraham, Avraham. So the rabbis all ask, why does he have to repeat Avraham, Avraham? Call him once. Avraham. What's the double language? So the Zohar says, listen to a beautiful Zohar. The Zohar says, Avraham, Avraham. Avraham le'ela, Avraham le'tata. Avraham of above, Avraham of below. What does the Zohar mean? It's a cryptic Zohar. Avraham of above, Avraham of below. So the rabbis explain as follows. Every single Jew in this world is born with a certain potential. And the goal of every Jew is that potential should be realized as close as he can to full potential. As a matter of fact, the Zohar says that there's an image in heaven of the finished product of you based on your full potential. There's an image of you. And when we get up to Shamayim, they're going to look at what you look like and what you were supposed to look like. And the closer you are to your image of potential, then already, that's the way they judge you. You know, fellows will get up there in shorts, with a tennis racket, smiling, on a bicycle maybe, and they're going to see an image of them with a long beard and a hat and gemariot and students. You know, who's that? I mean, who's that? That's you. That's me. You got the wrong guy. No. You blew it. You wasted your time. This was your potential, but you got sidetracked. Therefore, the Zohar says, the goal of man and lady is, of human beings is, in order to try to reach their full potential to match the images. Unfortunately, few people are really able to say they maxed out and fulfilled their full potential. It's not an easy feat. Avraham, after he passed the 10th test, God looks at the image of Avraham in heaven, the finished product. He looks at the image of Avraham on earth, and God starts to scream out, Avraham, Avraham, it's a match! The Avraham of above is the same image of Avraham of below. Avraham, you passed the 10th and final test. You've reached your potential to show you the gadlut of the avot. They didn't waste a second of their time and they were able to accomplish what they were supposed to in life. Lastly, all the way at the end of the parasha, right after Akedat Yitzhak, there's a few more pesukim that go as follows. It was after the events of the Akedah. Vayugad le'Avraham ne'mor, and it was told to Avraham, somebody came to Avraham and gave him news. What was the news? Behold, hine yaleda milka gamhi banim le'Nahor achicha. Avraham, your brother Nahor had children. It Utz, it Buz, it Kemuel, Kesed, Azob, Pildash, Yidlaf, Betuel. 8 children. He took a concubine, Reumah her name was, she also had children, Tebach, Gaham, Tahash, Ma'achag. So all the rabbis, what's going on over here? What's the parasha teaching us? Who cares if Nahor had children? Who's Nahor? We care about his 8 children, we care about his concubine, his Pilegesh, and even if we do care about it, what does Avraham care? They went out of the way to tell Avraham, by the way, Avraham, you should know, Nahor is having a lot of children. So our rabbis tell us, simply, they're telling us this whole story because one of the children of Nahor was a fellow by the name of Betuel, and Betuel had a daughter called Rivka. So they're introducing now Rivka to this story, so they want to give you the whole family of Rivka, because now next week's parasha we're going to learn how they met. So the Torah is setting it up for you. That's a simple explanation. But let me tell you a deep explanation that one of the rabbis said. Avraham just passed the 10th and final test. You could imagine Avraham's life that was filled constantly with challenges. In one parasha, they're throwing him in a fiery furnace. In the next parasha, God's telling him, you have to leave your father's house and go to a land that I'm going to show you. Every single parasha is being tested, the most difficult challenges, the most difficult tests. Avraham by no means had an easy life. He was a righteous man, a good man, but he was constantly frustrated by the challenges that Borei Olam put in front of him. Now he finally had the hardest challenge. He almost had to kill his beloved son. Could you imagine the tension? Could you imagine the apprehension that Avraham Avinu had? And finally it's finished and it's over and he passed the test. The Satan says, I didn't give up on Avraham. I'm still going to get him. So he sends a messenger to Avraham. And you know what the messenger says? You know your brother Nahor, the Rasha, the Mehalel Shabbat, the gangster, the guy who doesn't follow any religion? His wife is having children like guppies. His wife is marrying concubines and so on. He's rolling. A lesser man than Avraham, you know what would say? God, you're not fair. I'm the good guy. I had to squeeze out a child after how many years of praying. This guy does nothing. He has children like water. He's having an enjoyable life. My one son that you gave me, I almost had to kill him. It's not fair, God. I'm getting a raw deal. I'm a tzaddik and I suffer, and he's a rasha and he flourishes. That's what a lesser man would have said. But you know what Avraham's reaction is? Good for him. What do I care if Nahor's having children? Mabruk, Siman Tov, let him have all the children in the world. Avraham was not questioning God's judgment. It's a great lesson to learn. That many times as religious ladies, we come to class, we're modest, we do, and we see our friends that don't do half as much as what we do. But they're having a lot more success in the things in life that we would wish we'd have success. So we say, it's not fair. God, you mixed it up. I'm the good one. They're the bad one. The judgment is off. And that's what they're telling us about Avraham. Avraham, if the hardest test to Avraham was not to get fooled. Sometimes even righteous, good people, God has it in his wisdom, for whatever reason it is, to judge them as he sees fit. Don't get fooled. It doesn't mean that God made a mistake, Chas v'Shalom. God knows exactly what he's doing. There's a reason why the righteous suffer, and there's a reason why the wicked prosper. Avraham passed the Akedah, but he passed the post-Akedah test, which was hearing that his brother Nahor was being successful. And the test was to retain a solid emunah.